You engineered my ruin. You mapped my entire life for 11 months just to back me into a corner.
The marriage contract was a calculation, Graciela. But what came after is something I have no power to stop.
A virgin girl was forced to marry a paralyzed duke. Then everything changed. She did not know her steps had been counted. She did not know that for 11 months, a team of private investigators had been mapping every corner of her quiet, struggling life, her apothecary debts, her sleepless nights at the clinic, her grandmother Ruth's fading medical charts. Before a single word was ever spoken to her, Graciela Truhl believed the worst had already come. She was wrong. The morning a heavy parchment envelope arrived, sealed in black wax, no return address. Only her full legal name, her life stopped belonging to her, because the man who sent it did not make requests. Duke Peter Costanzo made calculations, and he had already decided she had no other choice. He was paralyzed from the waist down, feared across three counties, and he had chosen her a debt-ridden girl who smelled of sulfur and tallow soap to wear his name. What Graciela did not yet know was why, and when she finally found out, it did not break her. It broke him. Welcome to Forbidden Secret Love Chronicles. If you're ready for stories where the unexpected happens, where the forgotten rise and the underdogs turn the game around, hit that subscribe button now. You don't want to miss what's coming next. Drop a comment below and tell me your name, where you're watching from, and what's on your mind. Your name might be the one called out at the start of the next story. Like, share. And hit that notification bell so you never miss the drama, the revenge, and the secrets waiting to be uncovered. Welcome to the family. Now let's dive in. The envelope had no return address. That was the first thing Graciela noticed. No sender, no crest, no stamp, nothing on the outside except her name. Written in clean, deliberate black ink. Graciela Maeve Truhl. Not the shortened version she gave to merchants. Not the name she scrawled on clinic receipts or pressed into wax on debt acknowledgments. Her full legal name, the one that only existed in documents, she kept folded beneath the loose floorboard beside her grandmother's bed. She almost did not open it. She had returned to her cramped room that night, after a punishing 12-hour shift at the apothecary clinic. Her fingers raw from mixing sulfur compounds, her dress smelling of tallow soap and camphor oil. There was a bruise forming along the side of her left hand where the heavy medicine chest had caught her as she rushed down the corridor to a patient who had stopped breathing. She was 3 weeks behind on her rent, 4 months behind on the sanatorium bills, and she had eaten the same thin barley porridge 2 evenings in a row because the alternative was not eating at all. An envelope with no return address was not even among the 5 most pressing concerns she carried into that room, but something made her open it. Perhaps her hands were already moving without permission. Perhaps, and this was the thought that would haunt her long after that night, some part of her already knew. Inside was a single card. Thick paper. The kind that was pressed from linen pulp and cost more per sheet than most laborers earned in a day. On it, printed in the same clean, unhurried black type, "Your grandmother, Ruth Aline Truhl, has been identified for a conversation with our client. A representative will call at your residence at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. Please be present." No signature. No firm name. No explanation for how they knew her grandmother's full middle name. Graciela read it twice. Then she set it flat on the table and stood very still while the tallow candle on the shelf threw long, unsteady shadows across the wall. She thought about Ruth lying in her narrow bed at Holloway Private Sanatorium, 3 streets east, and 1 world away. She thought about the doctor who had drawn her aside last week and spoken in the careful, softened voice that medical men used when they did not want to say a number out loud. She thought about the stack of unpaid bills beneath that floorboard, the ones from September and August before that, and the spring before that growing like something alive, like something that had decided it was going to outlast them both. She picked up the card a second time, read it a third, identified for a conversation, as though her grandmother were a parcel, as though Ruth Aline Truhl, who had raised Graciela with calloused hands and absolute devotion after both her parents were taken by fever, were simply a line item in someone's ledger. Graciela almost threw the card into the candle flame. She did not throw it. She was awake before 5 the next morning, seated at her narrow table in her cleanest gray dress, her dark hair pinned up tightly, her hands folded in her lap with a stillness she did not feel inside. She had spent the hours before dawn doing the only thing she knew how to do when the world pressed in. She ran the numbers. She pulled out every bill, every receipt, every figure she had memorized because looking at them directly had become too painful. She calculated what Ruth's care would cost over the next 6 months, then the next 12, then 3 years, if the body held. The number she arrived at by candlelight was not a number she would ever earn in time. At 7 o'clock precisely, a sharp knock landed on her door. Not the hesitant knock of a neighbor, not the heavy, impatient knock of a rent collector. Measured, deliberate, the knock of someone who was accustomed to doors opening when they knocked. The man standing in the doorway wore a dark wool coat without a single crease in it, despite the bitter morning cold. He was somewhere past 50, with close-cropped gray hair, a lean face, and eyes that assessed the room behind Graciella in a single sweep before settling back on her with the pleasant blankness of a man paid to reveal nothing. His name, he said, was Solicitor Aldous Fenwick. He represented a private client. He was very sorry for the unusual hour. He had a proposition he had been instructed to deliver in full, and he had been further instructed not to leave without her answer. He sat across from her at the narrow table with a leather satchel on his knee and opened it without ceremony. The proposition, as Fenwick laid it out in the flat, precise language of legal documents, was this. Graciella Maeve Truel was to enter into a formal marriage of convenience with Duke Peter Aldrich Costanzo of Costanzo Hall in the county of Derbyshire. The marriage would stand for a period of 12 calendar months. During those 12 months, she would reside at Costanzo Hall, conduct herself in all public settings as a devoted and contented duchess, maintain absolute confidentiality regarding the private nature of the arrangement, and fulfill certain social obligations as directed by the Duke's household management. In exchange, the entirety of Ruth Aline Trull's outstanding sanatorium debt would be cleared within 4 working days of signing. Ruth's care physician visits, medicines, specialist consultations, and residential costs would be funded in full for the duration of her life, administered through an irrevocable medical trust, held independently of any party to the marriage agreement. Additionally, upon the completion of the 12-month term and the quiet, uncontested dissolution of the marriage, a sum of money, a figure that Fenwick named without emphasis, as though it were merely a courtesy detail, would be transferred into an account held solely in Graciella's name. The sum was enough to buy 4 houses on the better side of the city. Graciella sat very still. The tallow candle between them had burned down to a puddle. "Your client," she said at last. "He is the Duke of Costanzo." "Yes, he is paralyzed." Fenwick's expression did not shift. His grace sustained a spinal injury 14 months ago. He manages his affairs from his estate with complete operational capability. Why me? It was not quite a question. It was the kind of flat, direct demand that most women of her standing would never have thought to make to a solicitor of Fenwick's caliber. Fenwick recalibrated almost imperceptibly, a slight straightening of the spine, a brief flicker behind those assessed eyes. "I am not party to my client's selection criteria," he said. "I am party to the terms." Graciella looked at the document on the table between them. 41 pages, Fenwick had told her, bound in dark cord. Her name already typed at the bottom of the final page in that same clean, unhurried black print. She thought about the doctor's careful voice. She thought about Ruth's hands the way the knuckles had swollen over the winter, the way Ruth hid them in her lap when she thought no one was watching, because Ruth had never once in her life asked anyone to pity her. There were no other options. Graciella had run the numbers across 4 separate mornings in the dark, and the answer had not changed. There were no other options. She picked up the pen. She read every page first. All 41. Fenwick sat without complaint for the hour it took her, refilling his own glass from the small jug of water she set before him, as if he had expected nothing less. When she reached the clause governing Ruth's medical trust, she read it twice, then looked up. "This trust," she said, "it is independent of the marriage. If the arrangement ends early, for any reason, the trust continues." "That is correct. I want that reconfirmed in an addendum, in language that cannot be reinterpreted, signed by your client, not by his representative." A pause. "Then, I will communicate that to His Grace. You will include it before I sign." Another pause. Shorter this time. "Yes, I will include it." She signed on a gray Tuesday morning in February, with frost still hard on the window glass and the city moving through its first gray hour outside. Fenwick gathered the document with the same untroubled efficiency with which he had laid it out. He told her a carriage would arrive in 3 days. She should bring what she needed. The household would provide everything else. When he was gone, Graciela sat alone at the table for a long time, the candle finally out, the room cold. She did not feel relief. She did not feel fear, precisely. What she felt was the particular, terrible calm of a person who has just done the only thing available to them and is now waiting to find out what it costs. 3 days later, at dawn, a black carriage rolled to a stop outside her building. It was not an ordinary hire carriage. The exterior was lacquered a deep, deliberate black, with no crest on the door panel and curtains drawn tight across both windows. Two outriders flanked it on horseback, both in dark coats, both watching the street with the practiced stillness of men paid to watch and say nothing. The driver did not speak. He simply descended, opened the carriage door, and stood to one side. Graciela carried her own trunk to the curb. Neither outrider moved to assist. She noted that, and she noted the fact that she noticed it, filing it under what she was already beginning to think of as the grammar of this arrangement, a grammar that would take time to fully read. She climbed in. The carriage rolled before she had properly settled. The journey took 4 hours. She watched the city thin through the gap in the curtain, the crowded streets giving way to wider roads, the smoke-gray sky above the rooftops, eventually opening into a larger, colder sky above fields and bare-limbed trees. She did not sleep. She looked at the landscape as it changed and thought about Ruth, who had been told only that a benefactor had agreed to cover her care. Ruth had looked at Graciela across the narrow sanatorium bed with those dark, undeceived eyes, and said nothing for a long moment. "Something's on your mind, Gracie." "Nothing I can't manage, Gran." Ruth had made the sound she made when she disagreed, but chose not to press a single soft exhale through her nose that contained entire sentences. Then she had reached out and held Graciela's hand, and that had been worse than any question she could have asked. The estate announced itself gradually, first as a wall-gray stone, running further in each direction than seemed necessary, as though whoever had built it was making a point rather than a perimeter. Then as iron gates, tall and pointed, swinging open at the carriage's approach with the soundless efficiency of things oiled and maintained and ready at all hours. Then a long private drive, and on either side of it, old trees standing in rows so precisely spaced that they could only have been planted deliberately, decades or perhaps a century before, by someone who was thinking not of the present, but of what the present would look like from a great distance. And then the house. Costanzo Hall did not try to impress. That was the first thing Graciela understood when she saw it. It was large, severe, and large, and built from dark gray stone that had absorbed several lifetimes of English weather and was entirely unchanged by the experience. The windows were tall and many, but the curtains behind most of them were drawn. The roofline was unadorned. There were no ornamental flourishes above the door, no decorative cornicing, no statement made in the architecture beyond a single irrefutable one. This building had been here for a very long time, and it intended to remain. A woman was waiting at the top of the stone steps. She was somewhere in her late 40s, slim and upright, with dark hair swept back from a face that communicated nothing unnecessary. She wore a black dress and a small set of keys on a chatelaine at her hip, the unmistakable uniform of a head of household. She descended 2 steps as Graciella climbed out of the carriage, and she introduced herself with a brief, precise nod. Her name was Mrs. Dorothea Vane. She was head of household staff. She hoped the journey had been tolerable. She would now provide orientation. Orientation, Graciella would reflect later, was perhaps too gentle a word for what followed. Mrs. Vane walked her through the hall at a pace that permitted no loitering and offered no unnecessary commentary. The main building contained 22 rooms across 3 floors. The east wing housed the Duke's private chambers, his study, his private gymnasium, and the rooms assigned to his personal staff. The west wing to which Graciella was conducted contained her suite, the formal receiving rooms, and the dining hall. The staff wing was separate and was not a part of Graciella's domain. Meals were served at 7 in the morning, 1 in the afternoon, and 8 in the evening, and punctuality was a household standard, not a courtesy. Her suite contained a sitting room, a bedchamber, a dressing room, and access to a private walled garden by way of a door at the far end of the corridor. "The Duke dines with you in the evenings, Mrs.," Vane said, in the same unvarying tone she had used to describe the position of the linen cupboard. "Unless he is otherwise engaged, you will be informed each morning." "And when we are not performing," Graciella said, "how much contact does His Grace expect?" Mrs. Vane looked at her for a half second, with an expression that was not quite surprise, but was its very restrained cousin. "His Grace's expectations regarding the arrangement have been communicated through Solicitor Fenwick. My role is the management of the household, not the interpretation of His Grace's preferences." "It was," Graciella noted, "a very clean non-answer." Her suite was cold but immaculate dark wood furnishings, heavy curtains in deep burgundy, a writing desk positioned to catch what morning light came through the tall east-facing window, and a fireplace that had clearly been lit within the last hour. There was a vase of white hothouse flowers on the mantelpiece that she looked at for a long time without quite understanding, before deciding not to read anything into it. She unpacked her trunk herself. There was a maid assigned to the west wing, a small, watchful young woman named Tilda, who knocked at precisely the right moment and unpacked nothing without being asked. But Graciella sent her away and worked through the trunk alone, placing her things in the order she had always placed them, maintaining the one pocket of the world she still controlled completely. She had agreed to 12 months. She had signed it in ink. The house was very quiet. The first meeting with the Duke was scheduled for the following morning at 9. Graciella stood for a moment outside the door to his private study before she knocked, not from hesitation, but from deliberateness. She had learned very early in life that the most reliable way to lose ground in a difficult room was to enter it unready. She drew a breath, steadied her hands, knocked. The voice that answered was deep, level, and immediately communicated that it was not accustomed to waiting. The study was large and darker than it needed to be, given the 4 tall windows along the south wall. The heavy drapes were half-drawn, admitting only a controlled amount of the pale winter light. Bookshelves lined 2 complete walls from floor to ceiling, dense with volumes that were clearly read rather than displayed, some slightly crooked, several with torn paper markers protruding from their pages. A fire burned at the far end of the room, and positioned between the fire and the large mahogany desk, facing the door with the intentionality of someone who had considered sightlines, sat Duke Peter Aldrich Costanzo. He was younger than she had expected. That was the first disruption. Solicitor Fenwick's language, His Grace, the Duke, the estate, the operational apparatus, had constructed in her mind the image of someone at least 60. The man in front of her was perhaps 35. Sharp, aristocratic features, the kind that came from generations of very selective marriages, a defined jaw, dark hair swept back from a high forehead, immaculate in a dark tailored coat and high collar. His posture in the wheelchair was the posture of a man who had decided that his chair would not change what his spine communicated. He sat as though the chair were a throne, and he had chosen it voluntarily. His eyes were very dark, and they were already assessing her with the same thoroughness with which she was assessing him. "Miss Trull," he said. The tone was formal, neither warm nor cold, simply the tone of a man conducting business. Your Grace. She crossed the room and sat without being invited to, which she saw register in his expression before he smoothed it away. She opened the conversation before he could. I want to discuss the trust. A brief pause. The trust has been established. I want to review the documentation, the specific clauses governing continuity of care in the event of any challenge to the arrangement. Fenwick confirmed an addendum would be drafted. I have not received it. Peter Costanzo studied her. The fire shifted behind him, sending light briefly across the angles of his face. It will be delivered to your suite before noon. I would prefer to review it in this room, with you present. Another pause. Longer this time. She could see him recalibrating not with irritation, but with something that looked more like the specific, heightened attention of a person who has just encountered something they did not fully anticipate. You are not what Fenwick described, he said. Fenwick described a young woman with debt and no alternatives. That is accurate. It is not complete. The Duke was quiet for a moment. Then, without any change of expression, he leaned forward slightly and reached for the small brass bell on his desk. When the footman appeared, he sent for the trust documentation without looking away from Graciela. They reviewed it together for 40 minutes. She asked precise, informed questions. He answered without condescension, which she noted. She pushed twice on the permanence of Ruth's care provision. Twice he confirmed it without irritation or deflection. When she was satisfied, she said so directly and stood to leave. At the door, she paused without turning. I will do this properly, she said. Whatever performance is required of me in your social world, I will do it with full commitment. But I will also know what I have signed. I will not be managed. She left without waiting for a response. Behind her, in the study that smelled of ink and old paper and wood smoke, Duke Peter Costanzo sat very still for a moment after the door closed. Then he turned toward the fire and looked into it with the expression of a man quietly revising a calculation he had considered settled. The days that followed were built from cold formality and careful distance, like a house constructed entirely of load-bearing walls with nothing soft between them. They shared breakfast each morning in the east dining room, a long, formal space with high ceilings and a table that seated 12, which they used 2 chairs of. The meal was served at 7 precisely, and it was consumed largely in silence. Not the strained silence of people who had quarreled, but the deliberate silence of 2 people who had agreed, without saying so directly, that familiarity was a currency. Neither of them was prepared to spend carelessly. Graciela read at breakfast. She had always read at breakfast medical texts, herbary catalogs, whatever she could borrow from the clinic before her grandmother's decline had consumed all available thought. She had arrived at Costanzo Hall with 4 books in her trunk, and she placed one on the table each morning as a kind of private declaration. She was still herself in this house, regardless of what the house expected of her. Peter reviewed correspondence. She watched him without appearing to the quick, precise movements of his eyes across pages, the occasional brief notation in the margin with a pen he carried always on his person, the way he would occasionally set a letter aside and look at it from a slight distance for a moment before returning to it, as if he preferred to think about documents before committing to a response. They spoke at dinner with somewhat more formality general topics, carefully neutral. The management of the estate's agricultural tenancies, a new shipping route from the northern ports that affected the coal interests. Once, briefly, Graciela raised the subject of a medicinal herb that grew in the kitchen garden, which she had noticed through her window, and whether the household had any use for it. Peter answered with more detail than she expected. The estate's former head gardener had been a keen amateur apothecary, and the conversation lasted 12 minutes, which was the longest unscripted exchange they had yet shared. The servants watched, not intrusively, but consistently the particular watchfulness of household staff who understand that their positions are directly tied to the stability of the family they serve, and who have therefore developed an acute sensitivity to anything that might indicate that stability is under pressure. Graciela understood this and played her role accordingly. Composed, pleasant, appropriately solicitous toward her husband in the presence of others, and carefully blank about anything that lay beneath the performance. She was, she recognized with a cold clarity, very good at performing composure. She had been doing it since she was 9 years old. It was on the fifth day, in the gray hour between 2 and 3 in the afternoon, that she first saw what lived behind the formality of this house. She had been walking the west corridor with the intention of reaching the walled garden before the light failed. The corridor crossed the manor's central junction, and from there a secondary passage ran toward the east wing, toward the gymnasium she had seen listed in Mrs. Vane's orientation, but had not yet passed. The heavy oak door at the far end of the passage was not fully shut. She slowed without meaning to. Through the gap came sound. Not violence, but the sounds adjacent to it. The grinding effort of heavy exertion pushed past its natural threshold. A voice low, controlled, but laced with pain, counting in steady, deliberate increments that refused to break. The periodic crack of what she recognized as parallel bars under serious weight. The long, grinding effort of muscle asked to do what nerve damage had partially withdrawn permission for. She stood at the edge of the passage and looked through the inch of open doorway. The Duke of Costanzo was in the gymnasium. He was between the parallel bars, both arms taking his full weight, his jaw set in an expression that was not determination, determination, implied the possibility of failure. This was something closer to war. His legs were partially cooperating. She could see the rigid, trembling engagement of his left quadricep, the refusal of his left hip to fully align with the axis of movement, the way his body was fighting itself with every inch of progress. He was counting to himself. Still, evenly, as though the counting were the only thing keeping the body from simply refusing, Graciella had worked in a clinic for 4 years. She had seen a great deal of physical suffering. She was not a sentimental woman about it. Sentiment was a luxury in clinical work, and she had long since learned to convert what she felt about a patient's pain into useful action, rather than useless feeling. What she felt standing at that doorway was not sentiment. It was something more complicated, a recognition. She had seen that expression before, on her own face in the mirror on mornings when Ruth had had a bad night and Graciella needed to walk into the clinic and be competent for 12 hours regardless. The expression of someone who has decided that the interior weather is irrelevant to the immediate task. She moved on before she was seen. She walked to the walled garden and stayed in it until the light failed, turning what she had just witnessed over in her mind with the same deliberate care she gave to things she was not yet sure how to categorize. The dinner, when it arrived, was like any other formal, served precisely, conducted across the distance of that long table. What was different was the letter that arrived for Graciella at 7 in the morning, 8 days into her residence. It was from the sanatorium, Ruth's lead physician, a precise and economical man named Dr. Albury Finch, wrote to inform her that the first tranche of the medical trust had been received, that Ruth's specialized respiratory treatment previously deferred due to outstanding accounts had been commenced, and that her grandmother's condition had responded with what he described, carefully, as meaningful initial improvement. Graciella read the letter at the breakfast table. She read it twice, then she set it down and looked at the window and the cold gray light coming through it, and she sat with the feeling that moved through her too large for its container, too complicated to name, until it settled into something she could manage. Across the table, Peter turned a page of his correspondence without looking up. "Good news from Holloway," she said. It was not quite a question. She did not ask how he had known. "My grandmother's treatment has started." "Yes," he turned another page. "I was informed yesterday that the disbursement had cleared." She looked at him for a moment. He continued reading. There was nothing performative in his neutrality, no careful blankness designed to communicate indifference. He simply appeared to be doing the thing he was doing. "Thank you," she said. He looked up then. "Brief. Direct. You fulfilled your part of the agreement. The trust was the agreed exchange." "Yes," she said. "But thank you." He held her gaze for a moment that was neither long nor short. Then he looked back at his letter, and Graciella looked back at hers, and the dining room was quiet with the particular texture of silence that lives between two people who are, despite themselves, beginning to take the measure of each other. The dinner that changed things, the first of several changes, came on the 14th day. Fenwick had sent word 3 days prior that 4 members of the estate's board of directors would be joining them for a formal dinner. Reginald Hartsworth, the estate's oldest sitting director, and a man who had served the Costanzo interests for 30 years. His son-in-law, Corbin Ashley, who had arrived on the board 2 years ago from a rival merchant family, and whose loyalties Fenwick described in a postscript as requiring careful management. A shipping partner named Lord Desmond Falk, and Falk's wife, Lady Priscilla, who was herself the daughter of a banking house and whose intelligence, Fenwick noted, significantly exceeded what her public conduct was designed to communicate. These were, the note made clear, exactly the sort of people for whom the marriage arrangement had been constructed. They had known Peter before his injury. They had watched the estate's board meetings shift in temperature since his physical limitation became known. They were looking for cracks. Graciela spent 2 days preparing. She requested the fabricated courtship story from Fenwick and read it until it was natural in her memory a chance meeting at a spring assembly in London 18 months prior, a series of letters, a private understanding reached before Peter's injury. She asked Mrs. Vane for a brief account of Peter's known social preferences and aversions. She spent one evening in the estate's secondary library, reviewing the last 4 years of the Costanzo estate's commercial ledgers, which were kept in bound annuals on the second shelf. On the evening of the dinner, Tilda helped her dress. The gown that had been selected for her, she had found it, laid across the chair in her dressing room with a note from Mrs. Vane, indicating only that it had been prepared for the occasion, was deep green velvet, with cream lace at the collar and cuffs. It was precisely the kind of garment designed to communicate a specific thing to a room, that the woman wearing it belonged there, had always belonged there, and had the resources and the ease to have not thought twice about it. She looked at herself in the tall glass for a moment. Then she went downstairs. Peter was already at the head of the table when she entered. He was dressed in his formal dark evening coat, the high collar and black cravat, his posture in the wheelchair as unyielding as architecture. He looked up when she entered. His expression did not change, but she caught the very brief, involuntary sharpening of his focus before he smoothed it back into evenness. She crossed the room and took her seat at his right hand with the ease of a woman entirely accustomed to the position. The directors and their companions arrived within minutes. Hartsworth was exactly what his 30 years of service suggested: broad, settled, professionally amiable. His son-in-law, Corbin Ashley, was younger than she had expected, with a wide smile and careful eyes that spent the opening drinks doing a quiet, comprehensive survey of everything in the room. Falk was large and loud in the way of men who use volume to fill spaces where substance is thin. His wife, Lady Priscilla, said almost nothing during the first half of the evening and noticed everything. Graciela matched the room with precision. She spoke warmly to Hartsworth about a rerouting of the northern trade passage that connected directly to something she had overheard Peter mention at dinner the previous week, and she watched Hartsworth's expression shift from polite assessment to genuine engagement. She let Corbin Ashley's careful eyes find nothing of interest in her calm, pleasant, giving away nothing about the arrangement or the nature of the household, leaving him without material. When Falk held forth at length about the poor management of a competitor's fleet, she asked a precise question about the tonnage capacity of the alternative route that stopped him briefly in his tracks, and then made him laugh, the genuine laugh of a man whose intelligence has been unexpectedly engaged. Lady Priscilla, seated 2 places from Graciela, watched this. Toward the end of the second course, Peter made a passing reference to the assembly, where they had met, a brief, casual remark, woven naturally into a larger conversation about the London season. Graciela answered without a pause in the narrative, adding a specific detail about the string quartet that had played that evening, a detail she had included in her own preparation, because rooms like this one looked for specificity and found vagueness suspicious. Later, as the men moved to the receiving room for their brandy, and the women remained briefly at the table, Lady Priscilla set down her glass and looked at Graciella with the direct, measuring look of someone who has finished gathering data. "You are very composed," Lady Priscilla said, "for a woman so newly arrived in a house of this complexity." "I grew up in complex conditions," Graciella said pleasantly. "They are not unfamiliar to me." Lady Priscilla studied her for a moment longer. Then she lifted her glass with the small, precise nod of a woman who has made a decision she does not intend to announce. When the guests were gone, and the house had returned to its deep late-night quiet, Graciella stood in the corridor outside the dining hall, her hand resting briefly on the paneled wall. The performance had cost her something, not the wit or the composure, though she had in sufficient supply, but the sustained, hour-long management of every word and expression in a room designed to find weaknesses, while simultaneously being aware of Peter's gaze from the head of the table, returning to her at intervals, she had not quite been able to predict. He had watched her work that room with the focused attention of a man evaluating something he had not expected to find himself evaluating. She heard his chair behind her in the corridor before he spoke. "Hartsworth asked me, privately, before he left, whether you had been educated at one of the city academies." She turned. He was positioned in the dim corridor light, his expression unreadable, in the way she was beginning to recognize as the default expression, the one that covered a great deal without revealing the category of what it was covering. "What did you tell him?" "I told him that my wife's education was her own private history and not a subject for dinner conversation." A pause. It was an adequate response. His was better. "She waited," he said. "Then she is the most capable woman in this county, wherever she came from." The corridor was quiet. The house settled around them in the way of old stone houses in winter. "Good night, Your Grace," she said. "Good night, Graciella." It was the first time he had used her given name. She walked back toward the west wing without looking back, and she was not entirely sure, in the quiet and the dark, what to do with the strange, unwelcome warmth that had moved through her when he said it. "If you're still here after all that, it shows you find the story interesting. If so, then do me this one favor. Hit subscribe on Forbidden Secret Love Chronicles. Also, drop a comment telling me what you think about the story so far. Tell me this. Do you think Graciella is already falling, even now, without knowing it? Or is she still too guarded for anything to reach her? Your thoughts are always welcome here, and I'd love to hear your take on tonight's story. Most importantly, your presence here means more than you know. The best is still ahead. Welcome to the family." The token she left was small. That was intentional. It was a folded piece of paper, not a letter. Not a note with words on it, simply a small square of paper, folded into a precise triangle the way her grandmother had taught her as a child. When Ruth had told her that the best way to let someone know you had seen them without making them feel observed was to leave something quiet in their path. Graciella had pressed a single sprig of dried lavender inside the fold. She had taken it from the small bundle she kept in her own dressing room, lavender being one of the few things she had brought from her own life, and not left behind when she packed that trunk. She set it outside the gymnasium door at 6:30 in the morning, before the household had fully risen, and she went to breakfast and said nothing. She did not know if he found it. He gave no indication at breakfast, and she asked for none. But 3 days later, when she passed the gymnasium corridor in the early afternoon, the door was standing fully open for the first time, not ajar, as it had been the afternoon she had witnessed his session through the crack. Open, wide enough to be intentional. She paused at the entrance. The gymnasium was a long, high-ceilinged room with tall windows on the north wall, heavy drapes pulled back for the pale winter light. The parallel bars ran down the center of the room, bolted directly into the stone floor. There were additional apparatus along the far wall, a low platform, weighted leather bags, a system of straps and pulleys that she recognized from her clinic work as resistance equipment used in nerve damage rehabilitation. The room smelled of effort and liniment oil. Peter was between the bars. He had his back to the door, which meant he either had not heard her or had decided not to acknowledge her yet. His arms were taking most of his weight, as they had the first time she had seen him work, But today, something was different. His left leg was visibly trembling, not the controlled trembling of a muscle under deliberate load, but the deeper, uncontrolled shaking of a structural failure, building toward a specific moment. She recognized that moment. She had seen it in the clinic, in patients recovering from spinal compression injuries, in the critical seconds before the leg simply stopped accepting instruction from the body that owned it. She crossed the room without announcing herself. His left knee buckled precisely as she reached him. The leg went fully, without warning, and the entire weight of him dropped onto his left arm and the bar, which screamed under the sudden shift of load. A sound came from him that was not quite a shout, and not quite a breath. Something compressed and involuntary, the sound a person makes when pain arrives ahead of the mind's ability to prepare for it. Graciella was already there. She did not catch him. She was not large enough to catch him. What she did was position herself at his left side and take enough of the weight to slow the descent, and then she guided him down onto the padded floor mat with the practiced movement of someone who had managed falling patients in narrow clinic corridors for 4 years. She did it without ceremony, without the sharp intake of breath that pity sounds like, without any of the softening in her expression that he would have seen and hated. She simply did the next correct thing. He was on the floor mat, his breathing hard and controlled, controlled with the specific effort of someone refusing to let it be anything else. She could see the tension in his jaw, the rigid set of his shoulders, the particular humiliation of a man who commands everything in his world, now sprawled on a mat in front of a woman he has known for 3 weeks. Graciella sat back on her heels and looked at his left leg without looking at his face. "Your hip is rotating outward," she said. "Every time you load the left side, the joint is compensating for an alignment problem rather than the leg bearing the weight through the correct axis. The leg isn't failing, it's being set up to fail before you've taken the step." Silence. His breathing continued to slow. "That is a clinical observation," she continued, in the same level tone she had used when she assessed patients at the clinic who needed the truth more than they needed reassurance. "Not a judgment." More silence. Then, from the floor, without looking at her, "Where did you learn spinal rehabilitation assessment?" "I didn't. I learned general clinical observation and nerve response evaluation from 4 years of apothecary clinic work. I have also read extensively on post-injury locomotive recovery, because I treated 2 patients with partial spinal compression and had to understand what I was looking at." Peter turned his head and looked at her then, directly. From the floor, with his dark hair fallen slightly across his forehead and his expensive coat rumpled in the most physically compromised position she had yet seen him, his gaze was exactly as direct and exacting as it was across the breakfast table. "Show me what you mean," he said. "The hip alignment." She moved to his left side. She talked as she worked, not in the softened, explanatory tone of someone managing a patient's feelings, but in the precise, rapid shorthand of someone who was genuinely thinking through a clinical problem and allowing him to follow the thinking in real time. She explained the angle of the femur in relation to the pelvis when the hip rotated outward under load. She demonstrated what the correct axis of weight transfer should look like. She described the specific adjustment in bar positioning that would set his hip into proper alignment before the load transferred, rather than after. He listened with the complete, undistractable attention he brought to everything. When she finished, he asked 3 questions. They were sharp, technically specific questions, the questions of a man who had already been thinking about this problem and recognized in her description the piece he had been missing. She answered all 3 directly. His rehabilitation specialist, she learned, was a physician who visited the estate 2 weekly from a practice in Derby. "A respected man," Peter said, with a considered pause that communicated more than the words did. "Respected, but trained in a traditional school that treated spinal injury as a matter of rest and patience rather than active mechanical correction." "I can observe your sessions," Graciella offered, carefully. "Not manage them. Observe. If I see the alignment issue recurring, I can note it." Peter studied her for a moment from the floor, With an expression, she was beginning to learn the one where he was doing the specific, thorough work of deciding whether to trust something. "Tuesday and Thursday," he said. "Renwick arrives at 2 o'clock. You are welcome to be present." She nodded and stood. At the door, she paused once, briefly, not to look back. But because the thought came to her that she ought to say something, acknowledging what had just happened on the mat, some small recognition of the trust that had just been extended, quietly and without declaration, in a room that smelled of effort and liniment, she decided against it. Some things were acknowledged best by simply showing up on Tuesday at 2 o'clock. She did show up, and the Tuesday session went better than any of the previous 4 weeks combined. "Doctor," Renwick, a tall, careful man who wore his uncertainty with the dignity of someone convinced it was expertise, observed the alignment correction Graciela described with the polite skepticism of the established, tested it at her quiet suggestion, and then stood very still when the result was immediately visible. Peter said nothing during this exchange, but that evening at dinner, when the silence between them had its usual texture, he picked up his wine glass and held it briefly toward her, the smallest, driest possible version of a toast, and she acknowledged it with a single, composed nod, and they both returned to their plates, and neither of them mentioned it again. But the gymnasium door, from that week on, was always open when she passed. The charity gala was Mrs. Vane's production entirely, which meant it was flawless and terrifying in equal measure. It was held in the estate's great hall, a room that Graciela had not yet been admitted to, which existed in the central body of the manor as a sort of formal heart, used only for occasions of sufficient magnitude to justify the cost of heating it. For the gala, it had been heated, lit by 3 tiers of wax candles in the chandeliers above, and dressed with long tables of white linen and hothouse flowers, and the particular kind of accumulated splendor that old money produced, not by spending extravagantly, but by having owned beautiful things for so long that beauty had become a abbey. The guests numbered nearly 60. They arrived by private carriage over the course of an hour, filling the hall with the sound of rustling fabrics and the specific conversational register of people who considered themselves important and had organized enough of the world to support that conclusion. Graciela moved through them at Peter's side, his chair moving smoothly over the polished floor, her hand resting at the appropriate proximity to suggest ease and intimacy without overperforming it. She had become, over the previous weeks, rather good at this particular calibration. The first 2 hours of the gala passed in the work of performance, the careful, sustained labor of being precisely what the room expected, composed, warm, privately devoted, appropriately gracious with the older guests, and precisely self-possessed with the ones who looked for weakness in youth. She spoke with Hartsworth's wife, a comfortable woman named Sybil, who was interested mainly in the estate's kitchen garden and Ruth's recovery, which Graciela discussed with genuine warmth. She navigated a prolonged attempt by Lord Falk's nephew, a wide-faced young man named Prentice, who had drunk 2 glasses too many to determine whether the Duchess had any opinion on the Duke's business. Decisions. And she deflected it so smoothly that Prentice appeared to have forgotten he had asked. She was standing at the edge of the candlelit room, near the tall windows where the cold pressed through the glass, and provided a few degrees of relief from the heat of 60 people and 3 chandelier tiers, when the woman approached her. She was perhaps 50, with silver hair arranged with the precision of someone who had worn it the same way for 30 years and saw no reason to change. Her gown was dark blue, old money dark blue, the color of people who did not need to be seen. She carried a small glass of wine, and she moved through the room with the unhurried confidence of someone who knew exactly where she was going. Her name, she offered without prompting, was Lady Winifred Thrace. Her family and the Costanzo estate had been allied through commercial agreements and social proximity for 4 decades. She had known Peter since he was 12 years old. Graciela received this information with the pleasant composure she maintained in all conversations she did not yet understand. Lady Winifred steered her, gently but decisively, toward the shallow alcove beside the north window, a space deep enough for 2 people and their candlelight. private enough to be invisible in a room of 60. You are doing very well, Lady Winifred said, and the phrasing was precise enough that it stopped Graciella's blood for a full second before she smoothed her expression back. Thank you, Graciella said, carefully neutral. It is a good performance. Lady Winifred's voice was pleasant, conversational, entirely without cruelty. I mean that as an observation, not an accusation. The room believes you. Hartsworth believes you. Even Corbin Ashley, who believes very little, has stopped looking for the seam. Graciella held the woman's gaze. I'm not certain I understand what you're describing. Lady Winifred looked at her for a moment, the look of a woman who has weighed a decision and come down on the side of directness. I am going to tell you something, she said, not to damage what you have built here, and not out of any interest in causing harm to Peter. I am telling you because you deserve to know it, and because you are clearly not a woman who should be kept in the dark about the ground she is standing on. The candlelight moved. Somewhere behind them, a man laughed too loudly at his own remark. Lady Winifred Thrace set down her wine glass on the narrow windowsill and told Graciella what she knew. It had not been a matter of weeks. The search that found Graciella Truel the process that identified her, assessed her, and ultimately placed that envelope on her table had not been a quick survey of available candidates. It had been 11 months of deliberate, comprehensive investigation. Peter's agents, three of them, working through a private inquiry firm in London, had compiled a detailed profile of her life, her debt structure and its precise trajectory, the nature of her grandmother's illness and the specific financial gap between what the sanatorium cost and what Graciella could earn. Her psychological history, insofar as it could be reconstructed from the accounts of people who knew her, her hyper-independence, her refusal to ask for help, the pattern of absorbing pressure alone that had formed in her at 9 years old when she lost her parents, and understood that grief was something she was expected to process quietly. They had modeled, Lady Winifred explained, not just her financial vulnerability but her emotional architecture. They had assessed how a woman of her specific temperament would respond to the conditions of the estate, the isolation, the shared routine, the physical proximity to a man she was forbidden from treating as a stranger, the high-pressure social obligations that would force her to perform devotion until the performance became indistinguishable from the real thing. They had built, in other words, not just a trap, but a trap calibrated to the specific shape of the woman who would walk into it. They had chosen her because she could not say no, and they had built the conditions to ensure that even if she arrived with her guard fully intact, the environment itself would do the rest. Graciella stood in the alcove for a moment, after Lady Winifred finished. The gala continued behind her, the light, the voices, the civilized architecture of a world that ran entirely on the management of appearances. Why are you telling me this? Graciella said. Her voice was level, not flat level, in the way that a surface of still water is level over a very deep bottom. Because Peter is not a cruel man, Lady Winifred said quietly. He is a man who was taught that control is the only reliable form of safety, and who has never had cause to question that lesson until now. And because I believe, having watched the two of you move through this room for the past 2 hours, that something real has begun to grow in this house, and real things deserve to grow in honest soil. A pause. What you do with this information is yours to decide. Lady Winifred retrieved her wine glass and returned to the room as smoothly as she had come, absorbed into the candlelight and the silk and the conversation as though she had been there all along. Graciella remained in the alcove for 4 minutes. She counted them. Then she returned to the room, found Peter near the fireplace in conversation with two of the directors, stood at his right side, with the serenity of a woman who had just had the floor removed from beneath her and had decided not to let it show. She performed the rest of the gala with absolute precision. But something in her had gone very still, the particular stillness of a person who is no longer uncertain about what they think, but has not yet decided what to do about it. The library was at the far end of the east corridor, a room she had not been invited into and had therefore not entered. That night, she entered it. She had not slept. It was past midnight, the house entirely dark except for what the fire in the library grate threw through the gap beneath the door. She had seen that light from the corridor, and known, with the instinct of a woman who had spent 2 months learning to read this house, that he was inside, that he had also not slept. She knocked once, opened the door before the response came. The library was a long room lined floor to ceiling with shelves, the kind of room that accumulates books the way rivers accumulate silt, not because anyone chooses each one deliberately, but because a house of this age and this history attracts knowledge, the way stone attracts damp. A single oil lamp burned on the table at the room's center, throwing a warm, unsteady light across the dark spines of the shelved volumes. Peter was positioned near the fire, a document open on his lap. His face turned toward the window where the winter dark pressed blank and impenetrable against the glass. He turned when she entered. She crossed the room and sat in the chair across the low table from him without removing her cloak. The fire was the only warm thing in the room. She set her hands flat on her knees and looked at him. 11 months, she said. The silence that followed was not the silence of a man who did not understand the reference. It was the silence of a man who had been waiting, with the specific patience of someone who has known a thing is coming and has not been able to prevent it, for this exact moment to arrive. Yes, Peter said. You had my grandmother's name in a file before you ever sent that envelope. Yes. You modeled how I would respond to this house, to you. You built the conditions to ensure that I would develop an... She stopped. Her jaw tightened briefly. You engineered it. Not just my arrival. The attachment. Peter looked at her across the low table and the lamp between them. His expression had shifted the outer layer of it. The aristocratic evenness that served as his public face in every room and every conversation had gone. What was beneath it was something she had not seen before, because she had not known until now to look for it. The expression of a man standing on uncertain ground and refusing to pretend otherwise. Yes, he said, for the third time. The word stripped of everything except its own weight. Graciella was quiet for a moment. The fire shifted. The lamp flame bent sideways and steadied. Then what is real? She said. Any of it. The sessions. The dinners. The... She stopped again, and this time the stop was not from composure. It was from the particular pain of a woman who has let something in and is now not certain whether the thing she let in was genuine. Peter set the document aside. He placed his hands on the arms of his chair and, with the slow, effortful movement she recognized from the gymnasium, controlled, deliberate, the movement of a man asking his body for something it gives, only under negotiation, he stood. He stood at the fireplace, with both hands gripping the mantelpiece, his legs taking his weight with the visible effort of something maintained by will rather than ease. She had not seen him stand outside the gymnasium before. She had not known he could. He looked at her from the fireplace. Across the low lamp and the dark table between them, his face was lit from below and from the side by the fire, and what was on it was the face of a man who has spent his entire life constructing an architecture of control and is standing, in this moment, in the rubble of it. The 11 months was calculation, he said. The selection criteria, the profiling, the design of the conditions, all of it was calculation. I am capable of calculation of that kind. I have always been capable of it. And I have always used it, and I do not ask you to excuse it. His voice was level, but it was carrying something the compressed weight of a man saying the truest words he has said in a long time. What I did not calculate, Peter continued, and what I am telling you now because I have no interest in compounding the original dishonesty with a further one, was you, your actual self. The person who sat across from Fenwick and read 41 pages before she signed. The person who walked into my study and demanded her grandmother's trust reviewed in my presence. The person who sat on a gymnasium floor and talked about femur angles without a single degree of pity in her voice. He paused. The fire behind him was very bright. I calculated that you would develop an attachment. I did not calculate that I would. A longer pause. It appears I did not fully account for myself as a variable. The room was very still. Outside, wind moved through the bare trees along the drive. A low, continuous sound like something being drawn across stone. Graciela looked at him for a long time, at the man gripping the mantelpiece in a dark library at midnight, standing at a cost that was visible in every line of his body, saying something she could see it had cost him considerably more to say. She believed him. That was the terrible part. She believed the confession as clearly as she had believed the revelation at the gala, and believing both things simultaneously was not a feeling she knew how to carry in one body. She stood. "I need tonight," she said, not coldly, not with the performative composure she used in rooms full of people, simply as a fact, a true direct statement of what she needed from this moment. "I need to think." Peter nodded once. He did not ask her to stay. He did not try to close the distance she was creating. That restraint, the specific restraint of a man who has learned to use control like a weapon, and is choosing in this moment not to register in her more than anything he had said. She left the library. She walked through the dark corridor of Costanzo Hall, collected her cloak at the entrance, and sent word to the stable for the small hired hack that was kept for her personal use under the terms of the agreement. She drove to Millfield Lane, to the narrow terraced house where her oldest friend in the world, Adeline Marsh, who had known Graciela since they were both 7 years old, kept a warm, modest, unwatched home. Adeline opened the door in her nightdress, took one look at Graciela's face, and put the kettle on without asking a single question. She sat across from Graciela at the kitchen table in the small hours of the morning and listened without interruption while Graciela told her everything not in the ordered, managed way she told most things, but in the way she spoke to Adeline alone, directly, without the protective architecture, leaving nothing out. When she finished, Adeline wrapped both hands around her tea mug and was quiet for a moment. "Do you love him?" Adeline said, finally, not asking whether she should, not asking whether it was advisable or sensible or whether it served the terms of the arrangement, simply asking what was true. Graciela looked at her tea. "I don't know," she said. Adeline looked at her with the patient, undeceived eyes of a woman who had known her for 23 years. "You know," Adeline said quietly. Graciela said nothing, which was, between the two of them, its own kind of answer. She stayed until dawn. Then she returned to Costanzo Hall and went to her suite and sat at the writing desk and watched the light change over the walled garden until the household stirred and breakfast was called. She went to breakfast. Peter was already at the table. They did not speak of the library. They did not perform anything, either. They simply sat in the same room. And the silence between them was different now, not the deliberate distance of two people maintaining an arrangement, but the particular quiet of two people who have said the true things and are now waiting for the dust of truth to settle before they can see what remains underneath. Weeks passed. The hip alignment sessions continued. The estate's social obligations continued. Ruth's health updates arrived at regular intervals from Dr. Finch, each one cautiously positive, each one read by Graciela at the breakfast table, with a relief so steady and so deep that she had stopped noticing it consciously, the way the body stops noticing a pain once it is eased. The library confrontation was not mentioned directly again, but things between them had shifted the particular, irreversible shift of a structure that has been dismantled and rebuilt, even partially, along different lines. Conversations at dinner ran longer. There were evenings when they remained at the table past the time the candles had burned low, talking about nothing in particular, the estate's eastern tenancies, the peculiarities of Dr. Renwick's diagnostic methodology, a book Graciela had found on the secondary library shelves that Peter had read at 19 and remembered vividly. There was, once, a moment in the corridor outside the great hall when they had both reached for the same door handle and stopped, and the 3 inches of space between their hands had held something that neither of them named. She had not resolved what she felt, but she was no longer running from it. It was on a Thursday night in late autumn, 8 months into the arrangement, that the message arrived. Graciela was in her suite when Tilda knocked, not the measured knock of routine, but the quick, short knock of urgency that registered in the body before the mind had processed it. "Ruth," the message said. Holloway Sanatorium. Acute respiratory collapse. Come now. She was dressed and down the stairs in 6 minutes. The storm hit as she reached the entrance hall. A genuine autumn storm. The kind that came off the northern moors with the violence of something that had been building for weeks. Rain driving sideways, and the wind making the old stone of the manor shudder in its joints. The stable boy was already being sent for the carriage, but the stable was across the rear courtyard and the storm was making everything slow. Peter was in the entrance hall. She did not know how he had learned. Missus. Vane, perhaps, or the house's own intelligence. The complex network of staff awareness that meant nothing of significance occurred in Costanzo Hall, without the Duke knowing of it, within minutes. He was there in the entrance hall when she came down the stairs, already dressed, his expression carrying none of its usual management. "The carriage is coming," he said. "I have sent two riders ahead to Holloway. Finch will have the estate's private medical account authorization by the time you arrive." She stopped on the bottom stair and looked at him. "I have also sent word to Sir Bartlett Gorse in London," Peter continued naming, without apparent awareness of what he was naming, "the single most prominent specialist in respiratory medicine in England, a man whose practice fees were equivalent to what most physicians earned in a decade. He will travel north on the first morning coach, if the situation requires it." Graciela stood in the entrance hall, with the storm against the high windows and the lamplight unsteady on the stone walls, and looked at the man in front of her. Peter held her gaze. No performance. No calculation visible in it, or if there was calculation, it was of a different kind entirely. "Go," he said quietly. "I will manage everything from here. You go and be with her." The carriage came. She went. The road to Holloway Sanatorium was 40 minutes in good weather. That night, in the storm, it was 1 hour and 20, every minute of which Graciela spent in the rocking. Dark interior of the carriage with her hands flat on her knees, and her grandmother's face in her mind, the swollen knuckles hidden in her lap, the exhale through the nose that meant, "I disagree, but choose not to argue." The voice that had said, "That's not strength, that's just habit." Dr. Finch met her at the entrance. The episode had been severe, a sudden inflammatory obstruction, the kind that came without clear warning in patients of Ruth's condition, and resolved in one of only two directions. Ruth had been stabilized 40 minutes before Graciela's arrival, her breathing shallow but continuous. The crisis point passed. Graciela sat beside her grandmother's bed and held Ruth's hand in both of hers, and for the first time in as long as she could remember, she did not bother composing her face for anyone. Ruth's eyes opened at some point in the early hours. Dark, sharp eyes unchanged by everything the body around them had endured. "You came through the storm," Ruth said. Her voice was thin but precise. "Yes, Gran." Ruth looked at her for a moment. "You didn't come alone." Graciela understood, after a second, what she meant. Not who had ridden alongside the carriage, but what had changed in Graciela's face. The thing that was visible there now that had not been visible the last time they sat like this. She looked down at their joined hands. At Ruth's swollen knuckles, warm now under hers. "No," she said, "I didn't come alone." Ruth made the sound, the short exhale. But this time, it did not contain disagreement. It contained something considerably closer to satisfaction. In the corridor outside, where the sanatorium's oil lamps burned in their brackets along the whitewashed wall and the storm continued its work against the high windows, Peter was waiting. He had come. She had not asked him to. She had not known he intended to. He had simply come, in the storm, in his carriage, with the full weight of his resources already deployed in service of a woman he had never met because she mattered to Graciela. And that, it appeared, had become sufficient reason. Graciela stood in the corridor and looked at him at the dark, tailored coat, slightly damp at the shoulders, the composed face, the steady eyes that were watching her with an openness that she had spent 2 months only glimpsing in fragments before the careful management closed back over it. She walked toward him. She had carried everything alone for 23 years. She had made it a principle, a practice, a wall. She had told herself it was strength, and Adeline had told her it was habit, and Ruth had said it with the patience of a woman who had watched it cost her granddaughter more than she knew. Standing in that corridor with the storm outside, and her grandmother breathing on the other side of the door, Graciela Truhl stopped carrying it alone. "I love you," she said. Not performed, not managed, simply true, placed into the air between them without protection or qualification, the way true things need to be placed to count. Peter was quiet for a moment. The lamplight in the corridor was steady and warm. "I know," he said. And then, quietly, "I have been waiting a considerable time for you to arrive at that conclusion." She made a sound that surprised her, not quite a laugh, not quite a release of breath, but something in the territory of both. He extended his hand. She took it, and they stood in the sanatorium corridor with the storm running itself out against the windows and her grandmother's breathing on the other side of the wall, and the weight that Graciela had carried alone since she was 9 years old was still there, but it was no longer hers, alone. The 12-month contract expired on a Tuesday in February, exactly 1 year from the morning she had signed it at the narrow table by the guttered candle. Fenwick arrived with the final documentation. The medical trust confirmation. The account transfer. The paperwork for the quiet dissolution of the legal marriage, executed and witnessed and processed with the same brisk efficiency with which everything in Peter's world was processed. Graciela signed the dissolution documents. Fenwick departed. The arrangement, in its contractual form, was concluded. She spent the morning in the West Wing's walled garden, which had begun to show the first evidence of early spring, the soil dark with recent rain. A few tentative snowdrops pushing through the cold ground along the stone wall, the bare branches of the espalier trees beginning to hold the faintest suggestion of green at their tips. Peter found her there in the early afternoon. He came along the garden path in his chair, which she had learned to read like a text. The speed, the angle, the quality of attention that preceded speech. He came slowly today, deliberately, the kind of slow that meant the words had been arranged in advance. He stopped on the path in front of her. He was holding something. She looked at it before she looked at his face. A ring, very simple, white gold. A single small stone set without elaboration. Old. The kind of ring that had not been made in the current fashion, but had been worn instead, worn by someone who had loved it for a long time. "This was my mother's," Peter said. "She wore it before the title ring. She told my father it was the one she had chosen herself, before anyone chose anything for her, and that it was the one that counted." Graciela looked at the ring in his hand, and then at his face. "I cannot undo what was done 11 months before you arrived," he said. "I cannot rebuild that ground, as though it was not built the way it was. I would not insult you by pretending otherwise." A pause measured, the pause of a man choosing precision over comfort. "What I can tell you is that everything since has been mine. Not calculated, not managed, mine. And I would like if you are willing to begin again from honest ground." He extended the ring toward her on his open palm, not placed on a finger without asking, offered. The difference between those two things was not small, and she understood that he understood that. Graciela looked at the ring for a long moment. She thought of the 41-page document. She thought of the gymnasium floor, and the liniment oil, and the femur angle. She thought of the oil lamp in the library, and a man gripping a mantelpiece and saying, "I did not fully account for myself as a variable." She thought of a sanatorium corridor, and a storm, and a hand extended in the lamplight. She took the ring from his palm, and placed it on her own finger. "We begin again," she said. He looked at her hand for a moment, then at her face, and the expression there in the pale, early spring light of the walled garden, without the fireplace and the performance, and the weight of the arrangement between them was the most unguarded she had ever seen it. Spring came fully to Costanzo Hall over the following weeks. The kitchen garden showed color. The espalier trees leafed out. The walled garden, which Graciela had quietly begun to restore during the long winter months when she needed something to do with her hands, broke into its first real bloom. Ruth came to stay in April. Dr. Finch had cleared the move Ruth's condition stable enough for the journey, and the estate's facilities considerably superior to the sanatorium's in terms of clean air and space. A suite in the West Wing was prepared for her, adjacent to Graciela's rooms, with a garden view and a wide chair by the window, where the afternoon light came in at the angle that Ruth said was the precise angle she had always wanted. Graciela watched her grandmother walk the garden paths on a Thursday morning in late April. Ruth moved slowly, the careful, deliberate movement of a body that had come close to its limit and had been coaxed back with one hand on Graciela's arm and the other free at her side, trailing occasionally through the early growth at the path's edge. Peter was at the far end of the garden, seated by the low wall, reviewing a document with the same concentrated attention he brought to everything, but with his coat collar open and the spring sun on his face, a specific looseness in his posture that Graciela had spent months waiting to see become natural to him, and which was now, gradually, becoming exactly that. Ruth watched him across the garden. Then she turned and looked at Graciela with the dark, undeceived eyes that had seen everything. "He's different than I expected," Ruth said. "Most people are different than expected," Graciela said. Ruth made the sound the exhale through the nose, but it was warm this time. "All the way warm." "You look different too," Ruth said quietly. "You look like somebody put something down." Graciela looked at the garden, the snowdrops gone now, replaced by early roses beginning to find their form, the stone walls holding all of it in the particular way of things built to last, the house that had been a fortress behind its severe gates, and its military orientation and its deliberate isolation was still large and still complex and still full of the weight of its own history. But it was not a fortress anymore. Something had changed in the mortar of it, some cold material dissolved, some new thing grown in its place, the way living things will always find the crack in stone and push through it toward the light. Ruth squeezed her arm once, gently. Across the garden, Peter looked up from his document and found Graciela's eyes, the way he had begun to do simply, directly, without the management of it. And Graciela, standing in the spring garden with her grandmother's hand on her arm and the rest of her life arranging itself around her in a shape she had not planned but recognized as true, looked back. There is a version of this story that ends with the contract. With the 12 months and the signed dissolution and the fortune in the account, and Graciela walking back through the gates of Costanzo Hall the way she came lighter in debt, changed in ways she would spend years understanding, but free of the place and its complicated man. That version of the story is the one you plan for when you are sitting at a narrow table at dawn, signing 41 pages, because you have run the numbers, and the numbers have no other answer. That is not how the story ended, because people are not ledgers, because love does not ask for permission before it begins, because sometimes the most dangerous thing a controlled man can do is meet a woman who will not perform smallness for him, and sometimes the most dangerous thing a self-sufficient woman can do is let herself be truly seen, and neither of them will survive that exchange unchanged. Graciela Truhl did not ask to be chosen. She did not ask for 11 months of investigation and a trap built to the dimensions of her own vulnerabilities. She did not ask to be the calculated solution to a powerful man's need for something he couldn't simply buy. But she was also, in the end, not a woman who could be fully calculated, not a woman who would fit entirely inside the shape someone else had designed for her. She was the kind of woman who shows up to a gymnasium at the exact moment a man falls and, instead of flinching, corrects his angle. That is the difference between a trap and a beginning. If this story has meant something to you tonight, if something in Graciela's journey has sat with you, something in the weight she carried, or the moment she finally set it down, then this is your community. This is Forbidden Secret Love Chronicles, and these are the stories we tell here. The complicated loves, the women who endured, the men who had to break before they could become what someone deserved. Every single episode. If you are new here, welcome. You found the right place. Hit that subscribe button right now and join the family, because we have more stories coming and you do not want to arrive late and find the conversation already deep. If you have been here from the beginning, you already know what this channel is. You know these stories find you when you need them most. Share this one. Pass it along to someone who needs to hear that strength and softness can live in the same person. That love built on broken ground can still grow into something real. Drop a comment below and tell me where you are watching from tonight. And tell me this, because I genuinely want to know. Was there a moment in this story, one specific moment, where something shifted for you? Where you stopped watching and started feeling? Like, share, and hit that notification bell. Because the next story is already waiting, and it is going to find you exactly where you are. Welcome to the family. You belong here.